cool.
Can I move this now?
Yeah.
And it's okay if, like, in 5 minutes or so we just switch off these things so that it's not as loud?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I can feel it. It's getting much cozier. Well, thanks for coming. Thanks for Fee for inviting me to give a little talk. I just love this room and I love this building very much. And one of the things that I love about being here is that I feel like I can be all the different parts of myself. So that means that I feel like I could talk about many different things. So I'm going to try to stick to the topic that I put on the board, which is facing the planetary, which was coming out of a little conversation that we had, and very much coming out of some things that I've been doing and work that I've been doing, presentations and teaching and stuff. The word planetary is fairly new to me in thinking about this framing. So I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that. But I think basically what I will do is this. First, I'll introduce myself a little bit because we've been around, but like you don't really, probably most of you know that much about where I'm coming from or why I'm here or why I love this place so much. So I'm going to introduce myself a little bit and where I'm coming from. And that will include a little overview of how I've come to be thinking about the planetary and what I mean by this, because it's a very bold word to be using, and I'm approaching it kind of cautiously, but also I feel like it's necessary. So I'll explain like why on earth I would be using the term the planetary, which is so kind of big and ungraspable in some way. And what I'm hoping to do is, the idea of facing it, is like talk a little bit about at least what my experience has been of trying to, I guess, move from work that I've previously called embodied, or like I was using the phrase embodied research quite a lot. I mean, I still use that phrase, but sort of try to unearth not only the ethics of embodied research, but the politics, like to get to that level of the political, and to like how to think about, because there can be such a gap between what we find to be ethical in our own bodies and interrelationally with people that we know and we start to develop relationships with. And then there's this huge, apparently massive thing called the political that can kind of come crashing down, and it can feel like either we have to ignore it or it's going to kind of paralyze and destroy us. At least that's been my experience. And so kind of some of the ways that I've tried to get a grip on this thing, and why I'm calling it the planetary in this moment. So yeah, that's part one, is like introduction to me. Part two is facing the planetary, and if there's time at the end, I'll kind of maybe touch on like a kind of more specific, because there's a book that I have coming out next February, and I could kind of go into some of, but I think that's probably more theoretical than we need, and I want to leave time for conversation, and I want to finish at one, so probably just the first two will be possible. We're recording this actually twice at two different levels of quality. So that means that I think I would like if we can also record the conversation. So I'm just letting you know, like if you don't want to be recorded, then don't say anything, or do say something and you can tell us to pause the recordings. But probably we might want to share it. Well, I would like to maybe share this on my website where I often share these kinds of things. And sometimes I share them without the Q&A, just because then it's like only my voice and I don't have to worry about other people kind of being entangled with it. But then that's less valuable, actually, because often the most interesting stuff is the conversation around things. So I hope that we can record it if that's okay. Okay, who am I? I'm Ben Spatz, and briefly, I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I think of myself as from the Northeast U.S., somewhere between Cambridge, Massachusetts, also New York City. My parents are from New York City. My grandparents are mostly from New York City, except for one who is from Eastern Europe, and all of the rest of the great-grandparents are also Eastern European Jews, and they all, well, some Western European Jews as well, but European Jews who all came over and either fled the Holocaust or fled before the Holocaust or were in pogroms or various things and ended up basically all in New York City in this kind of moment of European Jews getting out and coming to New York City. But my parents moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that's where I'm from. And I have a theater background, and I soon discovered that what I was looking for in theater was not really the moment of public performance. And I think that's actually directly related to the topic that I'm trying to talk about, which is that this moment of public performance, when this kind of, what I would now say, an embodied research process, is suddenly shown to this audience. And the framework of that, this kind of opening, and the very much Western European framework of the presentation of a public spectacle, and the idea of a general audience, and this is language that I would not have had when I was like in high school and feeling frustrated with theater, but the feeling that I had on the bodily level was like, basically, that the things that are happening in the rehearsal space are more interesting than anything we can show on the stage. And the reason for that has to do with largely with duration of relationships. So in the space of rehearsal, we can cultivate long-term relationships and discover possibilities. And then somehow we're supposed to make this into this repeatable score, often text structured. But even if you get rid of the text and you structure it around something else, you still have this enormous pressure, which is now, in this context, I would say the pressure of the political that comes and is like, okay, now present your embodied knowledge in this frame, you know, and you have 1 hour and everyone's going to come and see it, and whether or not they pay money, there's this huge pressure on it. So that was really challenging for me. And I think in that also the relationship between the role of actor and the role of director. This is all Eurocentric theatrical construction. Like, you don't need that in performance. You don't need that in life. But the structure of theater making specifically creates this incredible possibility for the performer to explore these embodied things. But in the European theater lineage, basically, the performer is allowed to and empowered to explore bodily possibilities that go way outside what is normally allowed in our cultural situation, because they are sort of contained and shaped and empowered, but in another way also contained by this figure of the director. And of course, there's many explorations of that figure. I'm using the word director in a specific way, like it doesn't have to be a tyrannical figure, but it can be a tyrannical figure, let's say. And in fact, some of the most extraordinary capacities of the performer can be opened through a relationship with the director because of this kind of division of labor, which you could link to all sorts of things. You could link it to like a therapist-client relationship. You could link it to a top-bottom kink relationship. There's all sorts of things you could link it to. But basically, it's a kind of, now I would say, it's a partnership between two people where the people agree that we're going to work together, but the thing that we're working on is going to be in someone's body and not in the other person's body. This is very fundamental to all kinds of practices where we say, okay, we're going to work together. We're working as partners. It's not a hierarchy. But the thing that we're doing is in you, or it's in me. And so then you create this really intense and, for me, very generative, but also very problematic or delicate distance between the person who is like, the work is in me, and the other person who, okay, I'm helping you, but the work is in you. So I'm saying that because I don't just mean actor-director, like I cast you in a show and you say some words. I'm talking about the more generative possibilities of like when there's a partnership between the actor and the director. And yet, what happens in that moment when we say, you're the body and I'm the mind. I mean, it's like an enactment of the mind-body split, but in a practice, it's a practical bodily enactment of the mind-body split. So these are things that arose out of my search for a kind of theater that where I could explore these bodily possibilities that I was interested in, or that I desperately needed, let's say, and have a different relationship to the political, different relationship to the director. So biographically, I moved to Poland for a couple of years, and I worked with these companies that are post-Grotowskian. Jerzy Grotowski is a Polish, often called a Polish theater director, although again, that's a little bit reductive in that way, but basically someone who was working on this actor-director relationship very, very deeply. But those relationships are also very tricky. I mean, I think whether or not the director is tyrannical, And I've experienced some tyrannical directors, abusive directors. And then I've also experienced, you know, people who are in that kind of role where it's like, but I'll tell you this, the moment that the role of the director is not abusive and is not tyrannical is also the moment that you have to postpone the public performance. It's the same moment, right? Because the director is carrying the burden of the political. And when I say director, it could be facilitator, witness, provocateur. I mean, you can take it in different directions. But the person who's kind of on the outside, in the sense that they've allowed or decided that they've come into this agreement where the core of the work is in someone else's body, and they take on this kind of witnessing role. The moment that person is carrying the burden of, like, the outside world, society. They might not think of it as the political, but it's like the burden to make a connection between a bodily practice and the larger world. And that's, I think, where some of the tyranny comes from, is this feeling of, like, we have to do something. Like, how do we possibly respond to the catastrophes of the world, right? And it's like, well, if you have this relationship where one person is kind of taking the role of the planetary, let's say, and putting that on somebody and saying, okay, we're gonna heal the world starting in this room, go. Like, you can see how channeling this kind of force is very challenging. And if that person is not able to hold that force of the external world, then it can come right through onto the other person and be very harmful to them. And then there's the possibility where, you know, we say, okay, let's kind of cut or postpone that relationship to the outside world. We're not making a performance. We're not making a show. We're just doing embodied research. Then you can feel, like, immediately, like, the kind of intensity on that other person goes away. And it's like, oh, well, we can actually just explore the possibilities that we bring into the room. But in that possibility is then the possibility that this little space of exploration kind of floats away from the question of the political. It floats away from the rest of the world, and it can become this, like, very wonderful, amazing, healing place, which probably in an indirect way does, at some point, we think, we hope, return to society with something, return with some kind of healing energy or some kind of process that can go back, that can, right? But there are other risks there. There are other risks there in terms of that separateness, which is why I'm kind of still requesting that we think about the political and the social, or I'm responding to that need. So after I came back from Poland, when I was working with these companies, I was on the one hand exploring this kind of intimate partner work, that's when I began to explore a methodology of switching, where the role of the director and the performer, or the facilitator and the performer, are regularly switching. And so you don't have all of that kind of burden and authority and all the, I mean, I'm gonna say more about this, but, like, these are gendered and racialized roles. So when you're in that director role, you're, like, accruing all of that kind of externality, the distancing, the disembodiment of the witness, which is built into the Western theatrical frame. It is the mind-body split. It's built into colonialist structures. And similarly, on the side of the embodied practitioner, you accrue all of these meanings through your body, but you don't, you less and less get to speak. And then eventually you cannot speak at all, and you're like, I'm just a performer. I have nothing to say about what this means in the world. There's another possibility there, which I should name, which has been taken up by a lot of people, which is that you become a solo practitioner. Because as a solo practitioner, you're kind of working to integrate the performer and the director or facilitator in yourself. That is very valuable, very important work, but it does mean that you're working alone. So we end up with a lot of loneliness in that direction. So I have been looking for, like, basically ethical modes of collaboration. But while I was doing that in this kind of post-theatrical situations, then I started to do a PhD in theater and to go back into academia, which I had really, like, rigorously left. Like, when I moved to Poland, it was like, my feeling was, enough with academia. You know, I have only language and only words, and I have no way of doing anything. I have no way of making anything, because my way of making performance is like too text-based, or I couldn't find any way to structure. So when I moved to Poland, I specifically did not take my computer, and I was like, I'm not going to write at all, you know, and it was this kind of pushing away. So then when I was back in New York City and I was doing these kind of paratheatrical experiments, and I started to do a PhD in theater, and that's when the role of, I would say, critical theory or scholarly thought and knowledge started to come back in and to say, like, okay, there's something here in critical theory, theories of the world that are critical of the world, but engaged, but through thought and very much through practices of reading and writing. Practices of reading and writing were some of those that had been rigorously excluded from what I had been taught was the space of embodied practice. So the encounter of the director and the performer, as I learned it, we exclude even the dramatic text, which anyway is not a critical theory text in that way because we're embodying it in a different way, but we're excluding even that. But let alone, there's no books in the space, right? There's kind of, can't be books in the space because we have to have this like bodily encounter. So that was quite extreme. And then I was encountering this other quite extreme situation of academia where it's like, welcome to the life of the mind. Now we will just read and write. And there's no need for studio spaces. There's no need for open rooms. There's no, you know, there's no need for singing. We don't have to sing. We don't have to move together. We just read and write, which is also kind of extreme. And so for quite a while, I was doing these two things in parallel, and that was okay, but it wasn't really where I wanted to go. I wanted to bring them together. And in New York City, it was very difficult to bring them together in a lot of different ways. Like the theater context was high pressure. Renting a large empty room in New York City was like $30 an hour at the minimum, maybe 20 if it was not a very nice room, could go up much higher. So space itself was very expensive. And then on the other side, the PhD program that I was in actually kind of rigorously excluded practice, and they did not want you to write about your own practice, and they asked me not to write about my own artistic practice, which was ongoing, and I was making all these theater pieces and doing these embodied researches, but that could not be part of the PhD. So on both sides, there was kind of things that were making it very difficult to really do experiments between these kinds of spaces. And so then I finished the PhD, and I didn't really fit into the tracks of what was desired for someone to have an academic position in the US, but I ended up being invited to come have a job in Huddersfield, which is this little town that's not very far away from here. And so there I went, and there's a whole like personal dimension that I won't get into now about like what my personal life was like then, and that has also changed. But I moved to Huddersfield. I've been in this position at Huddersfield for 10 years. Initially, it was kind of just this amazing space where there were, in fact, big open rooms, theater and dance studios that one could use that was in the same building as my office where I had my books. And so there was just immediately this possibility to bring things together. And then also there's this thing called artistic research. Here it's usually called practice research in academia, but it comes from a larger context that I would call artistic research, where people are specifically trying to bring together these lineages. And basically, I've been doing that. But that doesn't really give you the framework for how I would now describe what it is that I'm doing. So in 2012, which is now a little more than 10 years ago, and now I'm getting towards what I mean by the planetary, when I was in Poland, I was working with all these companies that were creating, let's say, theater pieces, but longer-term process-based theater pieces. Like, you could work on one theater piece for, like, 15 years or 30 years. So if you work on one theater piece for 30 years, I don't know if it's really a theater piece anymore. It's something. But anyway, structures, repeatable structures of the form that could be thought of as a theater piece that were based on various traditions of song. And these were like world song, quote unquote. So they were like through kind of quasi-anthropological relationships with particular cultures of song, which might be like Ukrainian folk song or reconstructed ancient Greek songs or the songs of Georgia, Caucasus, Georgia, which have incredible harmonies, or Haitian Afro-Caribbean songs. And those are all different groups. So it's not like one group would work with one of those, but it's like one ensemble would be working with one lineage of songs for 10, 20, 30 years. And so I was working with some of these different ensembles and finding that this relationship to song was extremely profound, and it kind of answered a lot of the questions that I had about structuring my own embodied practice, which I had, you know, had found text-based theater very dissatisfying, and then I worked in dance quite a bit, but it was not really quite what I needed. But song was really it. So I was doing that. But then when I moved to New York City, it was clear in the context of New York City that it wasn't really going to be for me to kind of take up in a quasi-anthropological relationship a song tradition of that kind. So for about 5 years, or maybe more like 10 years, I was working with these non-lexical invented songs where I invented these songs that were sort of smuggling in qualities from the songs that I had explored and trained with in Poland. So I would take like a little bit of the harmony of a Georgian song or like something from the rhythm of one of the ancient Greek reconstructed songs, which were actually based on Ukrainian rhythms, and make a new song. And in the framework of Western theater and music, European, post-European, it's actually easy. You can make a new song by changing the melody and the words, because from that kind of register of what music is, it can seem as if the melody and the words are the song. So what I was doing was I was trying to change the melody and change the words and keep everything else about the song. And this was like very much an exploration of sort of the unnamed aspects of song, the unnotated, non-notated, non-written aspects of song. And then in 2012, I was realizing, like, I'm working with all of these different aspects and flows of embodied knowledge through these song traditions. But I was finishing my PhD, and the question of the socio-political context was really quite clear. And in the context of even theater making, it's like, again, it's like, here's this little isolated, unnameable embodied practice, which is like very generative and important to me and kind of a healing process. But how does it go back into the world? How do I name it? Like, what am I doing here with these song fragments? And so as coming out of that question, I decided to focus my song research on the question of diasporic Jewish identity, which then goes back to how I initially introduced myself as coming from people who Jewish people who fled the Holocaust or pogroms prior to the Holocaust from Eastern Europe mostly, and also at least one from England, coming over to New York City. And so, you know, what does this identity mean in transit? What does it mean in a diasporic context? I had some questions about that. I mean, really, I didn't have questions. I think I had a surprising lack of questions, rather. It had been given to me, let's say, that Jewishness was, first of all, something that I was and we were, and it was quite important that we were Jewish, and that was quite something that should be known. However, it was basically nothing to do with religious practice at all, certainly not religious orthodoxy, but even any kind of reform practice, like basically religion is out, and also any kind of Zionism even further out, like completely out. So then why is it so important that we're Jewish? What is that? So who cares? And yet it was important. It was important, and it was important, for example, to notice when there were actors and singers and artists and everybody had changed their name. Like Bob Dylan had changed his name from Bobby Zimmerman. And that was important to know somehow. It's like, we have to know this, that Bob Dylan was Bob Zimmerman. But why do we have to know that if it has nothing to do with religious practice and nothing to do with, like, ethno-nationalism? Then we're just sort of here. So I started to ask that question through the song work, and that's kind of the combination of the song work and the critical theory that I'm aiming towards. I discovered that, this is now since 2012, so it's a little more than 10 years, I discovered that it was not possible to think about Jewishness without thinking about whiteness in a very concrete way. So I started to kind of try to understand I started to read these books about like how the Jews became white, the price of whiteness, these books that are about the relationship of whiteness to Jewishness in the US in the 20th century. I found a book call Decolonial Judaism, which was very important because it took not only a US-centric perspective, but a kind of Western hemispheric Latin American perspective, Global South perspective, you could say. And then I found that it was not possible to explore whiteness or to come to grips with whiteness in any meaningful way without deeply engaging with critical Black studies and critical Indigenous studies. So I think I've spent the last 8 years learning from primarily critical Black studies, which is, from my understanding, the most powerful area of critical theory at the moment to understand many, many things. Diasporic identity, relations to whiteness, history of colonialism, kind of like, where are we? Who are we? Is how I've been naming it. Like, who are we? How did we get here? Why are we in this room? Why are we in this place? Why are we in this country? Which we can all have different answers to, but I find that critical Black studies is offering the most profound answers to these questions. I've been reading it in relation to critical Indigenous studies, also North American particularly, I'm talking about both. Also critical whiteness studies, which is its own little important field, and also critical Jewish studies, which of course Jewish studies is a massive, massive textual field, but the extent to which it actually engages with or names whiteness is very small. And that's part of why critical Jewish studies is not at the moment thought of in you know, if I talk about the context of critical race theory, critical whiteness studies, critical Black and Indigenous studies, critical Jewish studies is not really at that table yet. And that's why, because it hasn't really thought about its own relationship to whiteness. It hasn't really extricated itself from its European domination, its Eurocentric textuality. And this again is taking us towards the political and the planetary. Yeah. So I started to rethink my songwork practice in a critical race studies frame led by critical Black studies. I started to re-understand the lineages of embodied songwork as marginalized embodied knowledges that had been rejected by colonial frameworks. That have been rejected by dominant white European frameworks of what music could be. Again, I'm now going back to the idea that music is melody plus words, or even that song is melody plus words. The supremacy of the textual, a certain form of the textual as notation. So I started to rethink how the songs were working and what they were doing in my body, and I realized that actually the racial is like a absolutely essential framework for understanding what's happening in the songwork practice, and by extension, probably other embodied practices. I hadn't really been given that before. I mean, I think I kind of alluded to this, but like some of the ethics about interpersonal dynamics in the space of embodied practice were very informed by feminist and queer theories. But they remained in a certain way contained until I began to understand that they were contained by whiteness, and that I wasn't going to understand even the materiality of gender or the materiality of power dynamics in the room without looking at whiteness and without looking at the colonial and then what's now being called the decolonial. So I've started to frame embodied practice in that way. I've started to look at how race and racialization is present in spaces of experimental embodied practice or embodied research, or let's say embodied practices, embodied processes, to try to re-understand like how whiteness is structuring those spaces, and to try to look, I would say, like above and below the level of the individual, which I guess, again, is about facing the planetary, right? That, again, it shouldn't be that when we start to analyze these things, that that kind of force of the incredible, urgent, just overpowering need to understand and grapple with the legacy of European colonialism is like crashing down on one person or even on 10 people with sort of like, you need to solve this now type of energy. And yet, it's also not, this again analogy with what I was saying before, or a new interpretive lens for what I was saying before, it's also not the case that this group of practitioners can sort of operate as if outside of that framework and say, oh, well, we don't really need to, you know, we're just not going to look at that. Like, we, you know, we can't tolerate the force of that energy, and so let's not actually kind of deal with it. Let's, like, separate ourselves. I mean, that's obviously fine for a period. But I find integrating these different aspects of, like, embodied practice with scholarly critical race theory, that there's other things we can do. And part of what critical theory can do is analyze situations above and below the level of the individual so that it doesn't keep crashing on a person to be like, okay, how are you going to solve the planetary issues? Because that's not going to happen. But to allow us to think in different ways about, like, who we are collectively and where we are collectively on different scales. So, like, this room, the library, and then, like, the larger building, and then, like, the space around Liverpool, and then, like, England and the UK and Europe. And we can eventually start to think towards the planetary. Two things I haven't mentioned, and then I'll conclude with something that's a little bit more direct to the current events that were kind of coming towards us in the news cycle. Two things I haven't really mentioned. Well, no, this is actually what I said I would get to if there was time, and I think I won't try to get to it now, but the book that I have wrote that's coming out next February is called Race and the Forms of Knowledge. So I've been talking about race and why it's essential to keep talking about race, and why race does not only mean racism, and it's not sort of like, oh, those were the illusory categories of the past, so let's move on from them and not mention them, and then they will go away. They will not go away. They are embedded in the structures. They're like in the bottle. Like, the bottle is made out of race. The table is made out of race. The floor is made out of race. So that's the sense in which we don't surrender that materiality. I haven't talked that much about the forms of knowledge. A little bit. So, like, critical theory is a form of knowledge. Critical theory is a form of knowledge that I'm now reclaiming as explicitly Jewish. And you can understand that if you just look at the history of anything called critical theory, like, it's very Jewish. But also, it's been delinked from Jewishness. And the delinking of critical theory from Jewishness is part of the becoming white of Jewishness, which is still ongoing. And which now my artistic research process is much more explicitly to disentangle Jewishness from whiteness. Which brings us to current events. So we are impacted by these current events, and I think what I've been really wanting to respond to in, like, first of all, in, like, a series of huge Facebook posts, but then also sort of coming out of that thinking about other things that I could write and do, is this feeling, which I can really make analogous all the way back to this question about the space of embodied practice, and does it get crushed by the political, or does it separate itself in a kind of privileged isolation from the political? No. How we can mediate that encounter is, to me, exactly analogous with this kind of way that we get hit by the kind of a news cycle that's showing horrific violence. And it's like, what do we do with that? And it can feel like the two options are, we open ourselves almost in a self-sacrificial way, right? Because it's like, how can I not open myself when other people are being killed? So let me just let it come in, and then I will be kind of not killed, but, like, effectively killed for a month or so, which is not really helpful because you're adding to the loss of capacity. Or I can't really deal with this now, so I'm going to ground myself in my own embodied practice, whether that's a specialized embodied practice in a room, or it's like my embodied practice of everyday life, cooking, or the people that I live with, or whatever. It's like, let me do that instead. So how could we possibly mediate between these things? Well, one answer is critical theory. But I think the broader answer to that is, like, critical theory is an answer for me. Song is also an answer for me. Even wordless song. And both of those are very Jewish. Critical theory, very, very Jewish. We can go back to Marx, or if we really want to be radical, we can go back to Spinoza. But critical theory is Jewish. Also, wordless song has, like, a huge lineage in Jewish mystical practice. So those are things that I have found that are concrete technical practices, but by renaming them as Jewish, I find that they not suddenly, it's been a couple decades, but they have a sort of possibility to articulate themselves in relation to the political, because they can stand up and say, like, critical theory, non-lexical song work, aren't these sort of like very strong articulations of Jewish identity that is absolutely not ethno-nationalism, nor indeed religious orthodoxy, right? It's exactly the moment that they cross into this kind of zone of critical theory and non-lexical song work that they not only exit from, but they push against these kind of monolithic ways of formulating Jewishness, which is, turns out to be very directly needed in the world at the moment. So I think on the one hand, I'm speaking on behalf of non-lexical songwork and critical theory as really valuable things to engage with. And in some ways, I think the most radical critical theory right now is Black Studies. That also means that Black Studies is carrying the work of Jewishness in a way that Jewish Studies is not. And a lot of things that say they are carrying the work of Jewishness are not, but you will find it in Black Studies. So if you want, for example, to hold up diasporic decolonial Judaism or diasporic decolonial Jewishness, which does need to be held up and honored today, then I offer you non-lexical songwork and critical Black Studies as like, let's go forward with those. More broadly, I feel like I also want to be, and this is my conclusion, I feel like I also want to be offering this sense of like, when you go back to, not even back, when you like sort of try to analyze where you're coming from and who you are and what brings you to a certain space, there is so much knowledge that you have from your, we could say, ancestors, things that you inherited that are in your body, embodied knowledge, and emplaced knowledge that are present, but that are not named. And it takes a long process to rename those things, to rearticulate them, you know, like even just to say like, okay, this embodied practice that I do, this art practice that I do or that I teach, like what are the roots of that? Because very often the roots of that are marginalized knowledges that we're actually looking for, right? And they might be literally Black and Indigenous knowledges that have been delinked from those identity lineages. But they might be queer lineages, they might be disabled lineages, they might be other kinds of lineages that are delinked from the naming. Because as soon as you delink it from the naming, then you get the transmission of embodied technique. So part of what I want to say is like the transmission of the embodied technique is really valuable, right? It's not that we kind of, I guess I'm making a big case for a much deeper conversation about what is and what is not cultural appropriation. And I'm sort of responding to the way that term is used by saying, yes, we need that critique, but what we actually need is the renaming. So rather than saying, oh, I'm not going to practice this, I've been practicing these songs for 30 years, but now I realize that it's cultural appropriation, so I'm going to stop. Rather than saying that, maybe it's a question of like, what if I were to name the sources of these songs? What would that make then my obligation? What kind of relations would that then put me into? So we take the practices that we already have and the places that we're already living and we try to reconnect them to the places that they've been separated from their names, and suddenly we have all these different languages and all these different connections and relationships that desperately need to be explored and deepened. And like those relationships, I guess what I'm saying, those relationships are the ways that we can engage with the planetary in an embodied way and in a critical way, where we aren't trying to say like, okay, I saw this on the news, I have to immediately do something about it. Not that you can't, there's nothing wrong with that, but like to understand where we are and who we are is like to recognize like the way that something is hitting us from social media, it's not that we can immediately go and fix that thing. It's rather that we can fix or we can work on the relations that are linked to that. So like, for example, in the UK, when people are responding to the current genocide in Palestine, one of the things that I'm trying to do is say like, okay, we need to name whiteness in these conversations. But there's different levels of naming whiteness. Like one level, which I feel like my fellow decolonial Jews are doing a really good job at, is like naming the colonial situation that gives rise to the genocide there, like naming the role of the UK, naming the function of that kind of partition, the history of that, how that then becomes a colonial situation, how Jewishness is then split down the middle according to its relations to whiteness, and the Jews who are not identifying with whiteness or can't identify with whiteness are excluded from Jewishness, and then the Jewishness that is super identifying with whiteness gets to have a state. And so to see that history, but that's the distant naming of whiteness, right? That's like we have to name whiteness in the situation that's far away. But that also then that can allow us to also be naming whiteness and thinking through whiteness in our own situations. And those things are all connected, right? Like one of the things that I've been seeing is like, oh, okay, I haven't been mobilizing for Palestinian solidarity for the last 10, 20 years. I always felt like that's a little bit of a distant land for me, which it is. But that's because I grew up in the United States with no connection to Israel. But what I have been doing is reading Black and Indigenous studies for the last 10 years. And before that, I was learning all of these songwork traditions that actually are some of the same Black and Indigenous songwork traditions, but which were introduced to me without any politics, without any planetary perspective, just like And not to come down on that, but it was sort of like, these are the songs we need in our bodies. That's all we can do. And maybe that is all they could do. Like, all we can do is sing these songs, and that's enough for now. Because there's other situations that are like, all we can do is name the history and the politics, but we can't sing, right? That's all of academia is like, now we can name the history, we can name the politics and the identities, but we can't sing. And I think it's because of how powerful it is, actually, if you name the history and the politics and you sing. So I'll live with kind of that idea. Like, yes, it's a big stretch to be able to continue the embodied practices and understand the history of where they come from. It's not anything that we have to do alone. We already have communities around both the embodied practices and the critical naming of histories. But we haven't really been able to really have those conversations that put these things back together. And I think for me, that's the beginning of how we could try together to face this possibility of the planetary, by which I think I really mean the decolonial, a decolonial framework of the Earth. I'm saying planetary to create an alternative to globalization. So if we picture the globe as kind of mapped by European colonialism with its nation states with defined boundaries, then we have to kind of invent some other understanding of the earth that we're on. We could call it decolonial, but I feel like something that I'm trying to do in putting forward this kind of work of engaging with whiteness, and one thing I didn't mention, but just coming out of critical whiteness studies, thinking about all this post-Grotowskian work, thinking about the idea of critical whiteness practice, that part of what would be happening in critical whiteness practice, critical whiteness studies, is that we would be contributing, you know, and it's not so clear what whiteness can contribute to decoloniality, but I think that in a planetary framework, then it becomes much more of a concrete question, like, what do we do with that? And that's a practical question that we can answer on many different scales. Thank you. That's my presentation.
Thank you.
What time is it?
5 to 1.
Hmm?
5 to 1.
5 to 1. Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I open for any conversations, questions, comments.
I needed that.
I guess so. In terms of like linking. Talking about linking lineages, and I was wondering if that sort of formulation emerged from the sort of co-creation of, or like breaking down the sort of the performer director, or if it's a different aspect of like interscalar knowledge production. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. It comes from me from the model of the question of like, how are our identities present in the space of embodied practice? And what I've been thinking about in that context is, on the one hand, a kind of a dramaturgical analysis of that, where again, it's not individualizing. Like, I'm really interested in thinking about how race is present in a space of embodied practice. And I know that people very often get stuck on a kind of what I call a census epistemology of identity, which is like, oh, okay, so I have to be white or not. And then if I am white, I can do these things. And if I'm not white, I can do these things. And it's like, and then they have huge conflicts between, and not just between, but among the people who are, because everybody's been put in that kind of box. And actually the materiality of whiteness is much more complex and much more interesting and much more challenging and problematic than it would be if it were simply a census box that you tick or you don't tick. So that it's kind of like how to, think coming out of song work, I'm thinking about like the songs we sang yesterday, they all have lineages. They all have lineages and they're mixing in that space. And I was proposing them in this very open way, and then people were joining in with other things. So we're getting a kind of dramaturgy of lineages. And we could trace those to like specific musical inheritances. And some of them would be European classical musical heritage, but then there would be all sorts of what gets labeled folk or world music traditions that are in that space. And so to sort of say like, well, it's not the case that in that moment of the songs mixing, that like we are free of identity and we no longer have to think about power and we like rocket off into this beautiful utopian space of embodied practice. That's not really the case. But it's also not the case that we are burdened by our census identities, because it is the case that we can understand and transform our identities through practice. And so the way that those things are mixing in the space is, you know, it's not going to be understood by a census epistemology of race, but it's also not going to be understood by a kind of throwing out of, and by race I'm invoking a whole, I really mean the history of colonialism in the world. It's not the case that we can like get rid of that and be like, like it's pure vibration, as one scholar says. It's just vibration. It just all becomes, I mean, on a certain level, yes. But you've just abandoned, you know, in the same moment that you freed yourself from politics, you also abandoned politics. So you abandoned the potential meaning and power of your song work by saying, you know, in the same moment that you're like, it's just vibration, we're all here, it's great. That's the same moment that you're also saying it's just vibration, so it actually has no political effect. It's not going to help the world, nothing it can do. Like, no, I think we can actually claim the materialities and the politics of those things in another way. So that's kind of, yeah, because I think in the post-Grotowskian songwork practices, there's this sense of like, our company is now working on this lineage of songs. And it's, you know, kind of comes from a certain place. It might come from in oral, quote unquote, oral tradition learning, or it might come from recordings or whatever. But like, we're taking from this source and we embody it. But in that moment that we embody it, we cut off from the emplacement of the song and from the potential politics of it. So I think it's that question of like activating those lineages, but it's very much the question of how they come together in a way that keeps the critical in the room without totalizing the situation, which for me has become the distinction between a Jewishness of critical theory and what I started to call white writing. That is to say, when we're writing about the presence of race in the space of embodied practice, the white writing impulse is exactly to sort of categorize everything and box everything with this census epistemology. Like, where is that song from? Okay, then how do we deal with, like, you know, you can sing it and you can't sing it and then we'll be safe. And this is what I call white writing. And actually critical theory, which I'm reclaiming as Jewish, is not like that. It's like, well, that song is from there. So what do we learn from that? Well, let's have a conversation. And actually I disagree with you. And like, oh, that's very interesting that you disagree with me. Let's bring more disagreement. Let's actually, oh, there's another source on that actually that we could also bring in. And it gets more and more complicated.
I said lovely. We need that complexity again, don't we? I have something, I don't know. Yes, I also need that. You know, I do think it's a powerful conversation. So thank you. Because I'm one of those solo practitioners who doesn't take her gifts out into the world, who, you know, holds on to the idea of the vibrational impact is enough. And in some cases it is, it's very powerful, so I'm not denying the potency of that. But in terms of my humanity and my connection, my growth, my life, you know, it's completely incapacitated for growth and for connection by doing that solitary journey. And just on that whole director non-director relationship, and from a queer political angle, when I was at art school, at art college, whatever, Gwent, South Wales, fine art without any art, without any crafts and things, it was very postmodern and challenging, of course. And they wanted us to go and do some work in the local, like to go into Newport and do a 3-month piece stimulated by Newport and people. And I just couldn't get my head around it, you know, being the artist and the observer in that situation and making political comments or non-comments or whatever on other people, the whole. I ended up going in and doing work with a group of young women. And we gave them the camera, and we gave them the lead, and we gave them the power to press the switch and the button to take their own photographs. So it's about that power dynamic, really, the power, the camera, the lens, the masculine, taking power away from women, the director, you know, the person who's being manipulated to fulfill the other person's dream. So it was all about expression of. And again, it was interesting because every image that they came up with, it was very powerful and looking to see all these different, through drama, through pretend, seeing themselves in different states of being. And that was really powerful and led me to a path of community arts, and I sort of abandoned myself as a practitioner and left shortly after. Did the community arts route. But I teamed up with my soul brother, as is still, when we met at community arts training, and we decided to co-facilitate each other in an attempt to flip that whole frequency of director and directed, and to use each other's empowerment and awareness as witness to help facilitate the other to have expression around their own identity and what we were working through at that time. It was influenced by Rosie, Joe Spence and Rosie Martin's photography work. And it was a deeply healing process and very complex process. And in the end, I walked away from it because life got too challenging and I didn't want to immerse further in this powerful, intense partnership and dynamic. And it was interesting because we never wanted to show the work. We didn't want it to be a product. And then about 15 years later, all this work was popping up, which was reflected what we'd been doing decades before, you know. But there is that issue then of, well, what do you do with that? That history just lies away in photographs. So we never bridged it. So I think the conversation that you're having is exquisite in terms of helping open and bridge that possibility of, you know, more complexity and how we as artists or individuals who are doing their own process and understanding and to be able to bridge it with each other and help, you know, the expression that maybe then can work well to have more change. So thank you for that.
That was so thought provoking, and also your comment just then about like the how the importance of interdisciplinariness and actually, yeah, that's so true in terms of like the way that does it reflects some discussions I've been having this week about, like, I guess, like, there is yeah, I think in white academia, like a tendency to like, okay, you have your niche and you just talk about your niche and your niche is your thing. And it it does open up space to feel like you can't explore anything else and you can't, unless you're like, also like a form of perfectionism as well, right? So it's like you have to develop that rigor and that's so like, yeah, restricting. But then, yeah, I don't know, sorry, unrelated point, but like I think the what you were saying made me think a lot about Islam and Sufi Islam, actually. It sounds so much like you, like, yeah, like and I didn't consider this, but yeah, Sufi Islam is more like critical Islam, really, or critical Islamic thinking. And also just the purpose in which the new forms or different forms of Islam, like what it fulfills, and it's like this administrative form of Islam is very new and it's very intertwined with the Gulf states and, you know, imperialism. And I think, like, you know, it, like even in the Ottoman period, when you would have which is, you know, colonial period, it wasn't necessary to have that level of administration, so you would have that debate and that discussion and it would be more open and there would be, but that was, you know, even like, that's just to prove the point that it's like a very modern thing, this whole like rules based, very like rigorous, very administrative, and yeah, very white form of like, yeah, it's a form of control. And I think, yeah, like there is also a lot of singing in Sufi Islam, and yeah, that is, and that was quite an essential part of the rebellion against broader streams of Islam. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I was thinking about the just vibration, which is again a very purist white idea of it is what it is kind of thing. And the thing is, yes, it is vibration and it traverses all bodies, human or non-human, but how it gets perceived and how it marks the bodies as it traverses them is highly racialized, gendered, class informed, da-da-da. And I'm thinking of how to trust the reading, the somatic reading, the your embodied reading as an information towards critical thinking. So that, yes, we share. So what we've been doing in the listening sessions, we share exactly the same sound information, but how it transverses through our bodies is completely different. And then to have that a discussion, these differences to open spaces of conversation rather than saying that this is what it has to be doing and this is what it does. I don't know what it does. And the interesting space is, what does it do? Let's think about that together, and what does it speak of as it is doing that? So how this critical thinking could or is in some practices an embodied practice. And it's not two different things that have to be bridged. Which are the practices that each of us plugs into? Your access is the songs, metaphor, other people could be something else, but to really trust that this body-mind separation is not present, we don't have to reproduce it.
And like the body context, its unruliness as well, being a form of critique, you know, it's like, so, like, in these moments of like rupture and like force to kind of come back together. I mean, I was also like, I was thinking of grieving in this moment of, it's just vibration coming from like a spiritual healing context, which again, everything is like, it's okay, it's resonating. And we need the comfort of knowing that, yeah, we don't know what it does, because we won't know what it does, because the song still keeps going in the generation after, like in these different things. Like, it's not this short, closed temporality that we've kind of come to expect, which is that, the kind of idea of like whiteness and categorization. So, yeah, thinking with this it's not just like vibration, or it's vibration, but we have a material body for a very good reason. And like this kind of bringing down into something, and the need for this bringing down, also forming these like ruptures of that, like through pathologies, or these, like, where the body starts to resist and actually affect that kind of vibratory relationship as well. And resist these kind of categorizations.
One, also to continue thinking with, to not just submerge into sensation.
That's
the other thing. I'm starting to think from that, continue thinking from that.
Yeah, I really was thinking kind of throughout about one of the comments you made in the beginning of the listening session about, I believe it was discomfort, but it could have been disruption in my mind. Both words are kind of sitting in my notation, but that discomfort isn't necessarily inherently negative thing, or even if it is it something we necessarily always need to immediately exit, right? That there's kind of something in discomfort and in these bits of kind of disruption that you can figure out from there. And there's many ways in which I think, particularly by late stage capitalism, we're encouraged to encounter all discomfort as like a problem to be immediately solved. And I think that as I was thinking so much about that, is I think you've done this a really amazing job this of articulating this kind of false binary of either we have to encounter the entire history of a kind of planetary guilt or a kind of decolonial guilt, or none of it, that there's no way of holding that or something in between, right? Either it's a total encounter, which is a kind of annihilation of the self in a particular kind of, and adding to the violence or the history of that violence, or it's to say, then fine, like nothing. I can do everything or I can do nothing. That's obviously not. That then gives a person permission to exit, because neither of those options, or the option of doing everything is not viable. So the only other option is doing nothing, and you have to do that. But that's the false kind of articulation of that problem. But really, it's that discomfort of figuring out how to disrupt the desire to not be uncomfortable, which is also the problem with consensus. The consensus epistemology is also like a strategy for creating comfort or safety by refusing the discomfort of something else, something when we don't know the answer, we saw it kind of continues.
But you're not willing to like look at the ugly because you're too scared, because it's going to impact too much. Critical thinking gives a kind of more neutralized place, perhaps, where we can not just take it into the body or blocking it into the body and blocking it. Maybe like a little bit of a left right brain bridge opportunity for bringing more about what's going on in here, to be safe enough to still engage. Sorry, I'm not being very articulate, it's more an energy than a
this witnessing of where it already is, which we've spoken about a lot within like the work that we have been going through within Green, which is like, well, what would it, I just thought something new, right? And like, I just realized that how I have been colonized, for instance, like what would my life have been if it hadn't been under that or something. Like my tissues haven't been affected in this way. I'm thinking of like the work of Rosamund Menakem and like looking at clean and dirty shame, and like actually when we sink into the body, to be able to titrate our experiences. So this word that Sigmund was offering like earlier, like this notion of titration, just like slowly opening up to something, so our tonality, our capacity, our like vagal strength, like however you want to frame that, allows us to sit with something, allows us to witness something in a different way. It's showing us important, it's teaching and directing us, and like how can we identify these different moments, which I thought was, again, if we to try and map that framework on this like white writing, where the response is to continue like the thing that is known, it's hasty, it feels like quick, it's like, well, we must have the, like, it's, we must have the the tools are here is the song, here are the songs that I'm singing, right? It's like, here are the, yeah, maybe there's something different in tool use, right? So one's about kind of like a tool use and stuff, right? These are the tools that so far have like really codified in our bodies, like colonized our body, and like we continue to use these things, as opposed to being with the instrumentation of our physicality. There's something for me that's quite distinctly, and I'm formulating this now, but different about those two things. So the white writing is kind of like tool, an old tool, whereas yeah, the critical theory is like to be within the instrumentation itself. So within the embodiment of its relation. And only from one of those can we actually make have clean shame and something that is useful rather than like disappearing into this quagmire of histories and responsibilities that are beyond, like, and therefore we lose our accountability.
Because sitting in that discomfort, it feels like the white writing that has been spoken about is like this like legal imagination that is trying to hide some founding violence, whereas sitting with the tools is seeing it as a polluted body where we're co-creating the space right now. Yeah, and like this sort of desire to find a tool or find a societal sort of structure that actually is hiding its history rather than sitting with it.
Yeah, what brings you practice? There are moments, like, there are definite moments I switch between this thing as I'm moving through these transitions where I am writing myself, right? And I know, like, it's jarring, it feels, and then, like, I fall back into these moments I know, like of the body and contingent, and like it takes a lot to to kind of come out of those things. It's not just the knowing and the seeing of that, because it's always the moment, it's actually where the pain is. Like 2 weeks later, I'm like, what happened? I'm going to collapse for a couple of weeks. What was that? What process of white writing like put me into that state where I'm not used to anything either, certainly not myself, but like, yeah, noticing. That was very useful. Turtle cat. That's my assumption, but like, yeah.
Shall we go to lunch?
We should go to lunch.
Can continue over lunch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.